From the shady studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another arboreal hour of chemical-free horticultural hygiene. You bet your garden. All the recent Arbor Day coverage has reminded me that nobody seems to know how to plant a forsluggener tree. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll reveal the best way to install your outdoor heirloom to be. Plus, the phones have been ringing off the hook, so we're going to present a heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and truthfully told, tintinnabulations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you admiring a majestic living monument instead of a dying lollipop sticking out of the ground.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the shady studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another Sitting Under the Apple Tree Hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we present a recent article from the Washington Post revealing how some municipalities are adding trees to their urban landscape, which we are calling A Tale of Three Cities. Fascinated by the diversity of trees in the capital's Rock Creek Park, writer Nico Commenda decided to investigate which areas of the nation were adding trees instead of losing them. He picked three examples. Bend, Oregon, currently 20.4% tree cover, up 1.7% over the last 5 years. Originally a small logging town, Bend saw a huge influx of people over the past several years, as thousands of remote workers moved in during the pandemic. The city wanted to balance the need for more housing with preserving its urban canopy, and so new rules now specify that developers have to preserve the largest trees on a site or pay for up to 4 new trees for each mature tree they cut down. The greater Washington, D.C. area, 39.7% tree cover, up 1.10%. D.C. is an unusually green city. Together with its sprawling suburbs, it has just under 40% tree cover, much more than most other urban areas in the Mid-Atlantic. Luckily, the district started out with a mandate to be, quote, as green as the likes of great European cities. Since 2002, the city has enacted several ordinances aimed at protecting its oldest and largest trees. Developers who proceed with illegal tree removals face fines and can have their permits revoked. Tucson, Arizona, 14.6% tree cover, up a commendable 4.5%. In Tucson, where summer temperatures frequently reach 110 degrees, trees can make the difference between merely uncomfortable conditions and life-threatening heat. In the face of severe water scarcity, the municipality focuses on planting native, drought-tolerant trees like velvet mesquite. The city is also creating small curbside green spaces designed to capture runoff from occasional rain showers and reduce the need for added watering. On a hot summer day, temperatures in treeless neighborhoods tend to be 8 to 11 degrees higher than in the greenest parts of the city, explains Vivek Shendas, professor of urban sustainability at Portland State University, adding that urban trees will become even more important as climate change makes heat waves more intense and longer lasting. And the number of Americans living in cities is expected to increase by 18 to 36 million over the next 25 years. Now, that growth doesn't have to come at the expense of urban forests. Neighborhoods wanting to offer both dense housing and green spaces often limit parking above ground and install tall trees overhanging courtyards and walkways. Shondas says that any region not actively growing verdant urban forests risks putting the public's health in danger as temperatures rise. The coming decade will be the hottest any of us have ever experienced, he says, adding that, of course, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. But an ancient Chinese proverb reminds us that the second best time is now.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show, we will learn you how to plant trees and shrubs so they go on to have a long and happy life after more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mr. Mike. How are things in the Lehigh Valley?
Oh, they're just ducky. Actually, they'd be a lot duckier if we got more rain. We have had some real soakers, but we're still in what I call an invisible drought here, where we're many inches below where we should be. And it's the time of year where people don't really notice it, like when they have their crops fully in the ground and their gardens going. But it's a dangerous time for plants.
Well, I'm calling from Cincinnati. We already discussed that you've been here before.
Yes, yes. You know, great ballpark. As I've said a couple of times on the show, especially when I used to travel a lot to give talks around the country, I would always try to finagle a ballpark visit in with that. And my crowning achievement was I went to a conference outside of Chicago that I didn't really need to go to, but it was fine, and got to see not only a ball game at Wrigley, but the Cubs played my Phillies, and it was Ryan Sandberg tribute day. So I nailed that on all corners.
Yeah, it's a great ballpark. I'm glad it's still around, Wrigley Field.
Oh, yeah, it's a shrine. All right, what can we do you for, sir?
We live in a duplex built in 1912, so the buildings are relatively close to each other, about 15 feet.
Right.
And so if my neighbor has dandelions or chickweed or something else, chances are we get it also. So I have chickweed that's been taken over. I sent you pictures. It's in a duplex, so there's two front doors, and there's a walkway to each door, so the front yard is separated into three spots. And one of them is pretty much overrun with chickweed. So I did my research, and I understand some people grow chickweed. It's edible. It's called chickweed because chickens can eat it, but people can eat it also.
Oh, yeah. It is one of the forager's favorite plants. All you need for chickweed is moisture, and you can grow as much of it as you want. But it doesn't do well in dry times or dry soils. And it's so funny, my old friend Dr. Jim Duke, who used to study the medicinal powers of wild plants for the USDA, said that people who pull up chickweed as a, quote, weed, and then plant lettuce, they're trading down in terms of nutrition.
Wow. Well, I also found out it grows fast, it spreads quickly, and it's going to take over, basically.
Chickweed?
So I learned, chickweed.
Chickweed is, to my mind, the easiest weed to eradicate, even just by hand. You know, you soak that area and really saturate the soil, and then it kind of just rolls up like a carpet. The roots are as shallow as those of any plant, and it just rolls right up. The secret is to, if you want to get rid of it, the secret is to do that before it sets those little flowers. You get your chickweed saturated and rolled up before those white flowers open, and that should be it.
I've been mowing it so the flowers don't, it doesn't produce flowers. And I understand the roots are shallow and I could pull it up. I guess it just takes time and effort, maybe do it right after it rains or something. I also saw somebody said to smother it, which you've talked about with cardboard or tarps. And since it has shallow roots, that wouldn't take like months.
Well, it depends. First of all, are we talking about flat earth?
Yes.
Okay. You're talking about, I think you're referring to soil solarization, which is where you clear the ground completely of all green material, not worrying about the roots, saturate the soil like you've never saturated anything before. In terms of a corollary, you should create the world's heaviest sponge. Really, you have watered this area until water cannot be accepted any longer. The plants or the soil puts up a little sign, no more water, please. And then you spread out clear plastic, not black. I don't know who puts these lies and misinformation out there, but you spread clear plastic that is 3 mils thick. M-I-L, millimeters. And then you tightly hold it down on all the corners, and over the course of a full summer, it should solarize a garden bed, especially, you know, the hotter the climate you live in, the more sun, the easier this is to do. As you move into, like, more normal areas, it gets tricky. You get stuck with a rainy month, it's not going to work. But if you get lucky and you get a good, hot, sunny summer, yeah, by the end of the season, you can, you know, take off the plastic, save it if it's still in good shape. And what are you going to plant to replace it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm trying to eliminate grass because it's just a pain and it takes a lot of time and effort, and I don't use chemicals, and so I end up with chickweed or dandelions or God knows what.
Well, no, that's not why you end up with those plants if they're in a lawn. You're not caring for the lawn properly, and you're giving the edge to the weeds.
Hmm.
Very simple. Where you live, most people are growing a cool season grass, like bluegrass or fescue. And that grass gets sown right around the time when you're pulling this plastic up. So you'd be starting with a bed that's already, let's say, receptive, if nothing else. And I would just spread it on the surface, the grass seed, then cover that with like a half an inch of compost or soil and keep that wet and as gently wet as you can for a week. And late summer, early fall is the time these cool season grasses thrive. So it's going to be very aggressive. It's going to take over. You know, if you were a forager, you'd curse it because it's getting in the way of you harvesting your chickweed. So, and from then on, it's real simple. Do you have a lawnmower?
Yes.
Okay, what kind?
An electric with a mulching blade.
Oh, superb. When's the last time you had the blade sharpened?
I just bought a brand new blade for this season.
Excellent. You're in the catbird seat. Except, are we going to try to do the whole front so it looks like a plan?
I would probably do one section at a time because I got three sections, and I want to start with the one with the most chickweed in it.
Okay. Then when you take the cover off, set the blade height to be 3.5 inches and go over it. You know, after the grass is 4 inches, then you cut it back to 3.5. It will grow rapidly in the fall. That's its fabulous best time of year. It'll grow until frost, and then it'll just go dormant. So keep it cut at 3.5 inches. Keep that blade sharp, and the grass will thrive. It will fill in. Especially if you've got bluegrass, that'll take care of its own bare spots. And as long as you have a sharp blade, don't cut between 3.5 inches. And, you know, water if we go a week without rain, especially if it's hot and dry. There's no need for chemicals, and no weeds should appear in that plot. Most people just don't care for their grass correctly. And normally grass like this would also be fed in the fall, not the spring. That weakens it. So sorry, people who are busy fertilizing your lawns. If you have a cool season lawn, you're shooting yourself in the foot. But that should be it. It will crowd out any weeds once you get close to a stale seed bed established. So the right kind of seed, you've got exactly the right kind of mower. Keep the blade at 3.5 inches, and you should be golden. That's it. You know, unless you want to open up a chickweed farm, it sounds like you'd be making some good money there from the foragers.
I appreciate your help, and I've read before that the thick, healthy lawn will crowd out weeds.
And it is true. You will soon find it out.
Well, thanks for your help.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of you that I will answer your garden questions live and in person on Saturday, May 10th at the Nurture Nature Center in Easton, just across the street from the historic State Theater. The event is free, but you must pre-register in advance with the College Hill Neighborhood Association at eastonchna.org. That's eastonchna for the College Hill Neighborhood Association. Got it? Oh, and bring a shelf-stable food bank donation if you can. But don't go registering just yet, because we'll be right back to plant trees and shrubs the right way and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show, I get to vent a little bit. All throughout Arbor Day celebrations, I'm watching these municipalities think they're doing good by planting trees, by dropping bald and burlapped poor things into auger cut holes, and then piling mulch up against the top of the trunk and thinking they did a good deed. Instead, they should be hauled in front of the World Court in The Hague. I'll explain how to do it correctly after more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mary. How are you?
I'm great. Very, very, very excited to speak with you, Mike.
Oh, very good. Well, I'll try to tamper that down soon enough. Where is Mary great?
I am in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. We can probably see out the window.
Yes, you can.
All right. What can we do you for?
So previously, my husband and I lived in Bucks County, and we had a problem with carpenter bees on a cedar fence. We've recently, about 2 years ago, relocated to historic Bethlehem, and we have built another cedar fence, though this time we have coated it with three coats of very, like a translucent stain, you know, by preference. But we're concerned about carpenter bees. Is there anything preventative that's not toxic to anything that we can use?
Yes, but you should have called me before you stained the thing.
Oh, boy.
Really interesting studies have shown, well, first of all, cedar is the favorite wood of carpenter bees. It is known to be super durable and rot resistant, but it's also soft. So they love it when they make their galleries to raise their young inside that wood. They know the wood is going to be nice and sturdy, and yet it's easy to bore through. And, you know, they don't really they don't build nests in there. They just raise their young in there, and then sometimes the nests are reused by other bees the following year, sometimes not. But obviously, this is a common problem, and although they don't cause structural damage, believe it or not, people get freaked out because they're big bees flying around. And even though they are harmless to humans, we still have that primal fear of flying insects. So researchers testing out different ways to make the wood unappealing to carpenter bees without harming the bees found that if you coated it with almond oil, they were repulsed by that and they never tried to build galleries. Now, you have not had anybody nosing around yet, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, when I say almond oil, a lot of people are thinking, oh, when I go to Whole Foods, that's $100,000 for half an ounce. But almond oil is the carrier oil for massage therapists. They buy it by the gallon, like a gallon of vinegar. And if you get it from a massage therapy supply house, or even go to your nearest massage place and see if you can buy a gallon off them. It's very inexpensive. And what I would suggest, because you have stained it already, and I'm no expert at woodworking, so you might want to talk to somebody who has a brain and may have a better idea of this, but I'm thinking if you were to sand it down lightly, so that you keep some of the original stain, but that the almond oil has a chance to sink in and penetrate, that you should be good. And more importantly, if you notice the very first signs of activity, you definitely want to get out there with some sandpaper or sanding machine and sand that area down, coat it with almond oil, and keep your eye open. I would hate for you to do it after they start to build their galleries, because they are tremendous pollinators, and they're not hurting anybody. They're just raising a family the way they have for endless millennia. But if you can prevent it up front, they'll still be around. They'll just nest in a natural area somewhere near you and or in the neighbor's fence. And but they'll still come and pollinate your flowers.
Okay. Well, I think it sounds like we've done things out of order, but we'll try that. We'll try sanding the fence a little bit and trying the almond oil.
I surprised you, didn't I, that I knew something?
No, you did not surprise me, because I will forever remember the episode where you talked about the windmills near The Hague. And that, to me, was the best show I've heard in a long time.
Oh, thank you.
Very, very meaningful. So I thought, when I thought of this issue, I thought I'm gonna try to find out from Mike. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. That's a great memory. I really appreciate that. All right, you take care now.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. I was doing a lot of gardening work now that spring is here, but I had some questions about what I should be doing in particular.
Well, I have a big question for you
that
I need to have answered before I can answer your question. Where are you?
I'm over here in Yardley, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. A suburb of Philadelphia.
Yes.
And, okay, so what are your questions?
Okay, well, this is the first year that I tried to overwinter my pepper plants.
Okay.
And I actually had some very tiny peppers actually grow in the wintertime, but then all of a sudden it lost all its leaves. It got, looked like it died. But I decided I wasn't going to throw them out at this point, which I hopefully was the right idea. And I can now see some, little leaves coming back out as I'm putting it out with my tomatoes to harden them for planting soon.
Okay.
Is this are these things dead or is this one?
No, they're alive. They're alive. What happened? Did you forget to water them?
If anything, I may have overwatered them.
Remember what I always say, you water by the weight of the container. If you pick it up and it's scarily light, that means it needs watering. And the best way, of course, to do that is to sit that container in a sink half full of water for a couple of hours and let the drain holes pull it all up into the root system.
Mm.
But if you approach a container and you lift it up and it is super heavy, no matter what has happened over the past week or two, do not water that plant. It's already saturated. One thing, and part of this is my fault, I don't talk about this enough. Plants need to dry out between waterings.
Mm.
If you're down at the root zone of a plant and the water level is halfway up your roots, then it drops down to the bottom feeder roots. And then the water level drops below that, and the plant is in dry soil. Oh, my God, is it going to keel over and die? No. First, it's going to relax because it was tired of having wet feet and could use a breather. And now instead of even waiting for you to notice, those roots will push hard down deeper into the soil because they know there's water down there. And then by the time you notice, it'll be very late and you'll water it and everybody will start the happy cycle over again.
Good.
And did you keep them under lights?
Yeah, but they were sort of next to lights. I actually, you know, started up some seeds this time, so I had some lights that, you know, are going to be quite intense and right on top of the seedlings. But I sort of spaced these pepper plants around because they're each in little, you know, 5-gallon containers.
5-gallon?
Yeah, I think it's about like that. They're, you know, like a foot in diameter, foot and so high.
Oh, yeah, I don't think that's 5 gallons.
Oh, okay.
Sounds
maybe
more
a little
like...
bit more, but I've been trying to grow pepper plants into these containers instead of growing them outside so I can easily bring them inside.
Yeah, the container you're describing about a foot high and a foot wide is absolutely perfect to do this in. It's just the right size to give a single plant lots of room without the roots being crowded and it touching another plant, which slows down the growth of both.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't cheat. That's another reason maybe they got overwatered. Without light, they're not using up the water they have. They've gone dormant.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not photosynthesizing. And what happens when you get a lack of light, overwatering, or a draft, like a heat vent nearby, is the leaves fall off.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually protective.
Because now, the leaves are something that you can essentially do? Do we have to keep
them
yeah. under heavy light?
No. Oh, well, how many pepper plants are you overwintering?
Half a dozen.
Just put a shop light over top of them, put them underneath, just a simple two-tube shop light, keep them close to the top and give them their own area. I think that's 90% of the problem is they became light deprived. They are perennial if protected from frost, but that's not enough. They also need, quote, sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
To imitate their tropical native environment. And what about the heat in that room?
These are indoors away from the windows, so they were reasonably warm, the usual temperature we keep for the house.
Okay, good. No, that's fine. It sounds like the only thing you did is you skimped on the lights,
mm-hmm.
And possibly overwatered as well, but it creates a vicious cycle. So when you take them outside, don't prune anything off because you've got woody branches, right?
Correct.
Wait and see. Give it a month to see what comes off those woody branches. And then anything that hasn't pushed out some green, you cut that off and you prune the plant and it should grow really well because despite your having tried to kill it, there's still a lot of biomass there. There's a lot of energy it doesn't have to expend to grow that root system and that trunk. So they should produce peppers pretty quickly. And the rule for overwintering peppers is they're the last plants out of your house. And they're the first plants back into your house in the fall because frost means nothing to tropical plants. They're already dead from 40-degree temperatures. They know
right.
nothing about temps much below the 50s. They need to be kept warm, and you're not gaining anything. You're rolling the dice with no possibility of winning when you keep looking. Oh, when's the last frost? Oh, they're predicting a frost. Well, if they're predicting a frost, the nights have been in the 40s, maybe high 30s. That they're not having a good time out there. Bring them inside, and you'll get the kind of results where you can pick and eat peppers the whole winter long.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind, because I'd like to have peppers in the winter.
Oh, it is. It's great.
Now, along these lines, another one that I did sort of by accident, but it turned out to be good, is rosemary. I had a plant out front, and at this point it looks like it's completely dead. But luckily I had taken clippings and put them into pots and started growing them in the over the winter.
And are they growing roots?
Yes. Yeah, they're actually about a foot or two high at this point.
How long are the roots?
I'd have to pull the thing out to actually find out, but I suspect that they're down there quite a bit.
Yeah, that's the problem. Once you allow those stringy white roots to get too long, they can't handle real soil. You want to root prune during this process to keep the roots. I'm holding two fingers. I'm holding a finger and my thumb apart. What is this, James? 3 inches, 4 inches, something like that? Yeah, don't let them get any bigger than that. Oddly enough, the more root after that, the less chance they're going to transplant well.
Okay.
And next year, bring in a rosemary plant along with your peppers. They do great inside. They're a little more finicky than peppers, but you can do it.
Are there any other plants other than peppers and rosemary that I should be bringing in?
That's all I bring in.
Okay. Well, that's good, because that's not all the space I have.
Yeah, exactly. You got to be realistic. Okay, Bill?
That's excellent news, and looks like I'm going to have some peppers.
Yeah, good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there who's getting ready to plant their peppers, tomatoes, and other tasty treats that it's always a good idea to, quote, harden off the small plants by leaving them outside for a couple of hours a day and then bringing them back inside overnight for, oh, about a week or so prior to the actual planting. And even though it seems counterintuitive, the best time to plant is in the early evening, so the plants have time to get over their transplant shock before they endure a day of full sun. But don't go adjusting your schedule just yet, because we'll be right back to learn you how to correctly plant trees and shrubs and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Is your landscape subject to invasion by animals like raccoons and groundhogs? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll discuss some of the do's and don'ts of backyard wildlife control. Plus your fabulous phone calls and who knows what else. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, hold that shovel. Don't do anything, because we are about to tell you the correct way to plant trees and shrubs. After another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Our number to call, scratch it on the wall, 610-694-8100, and don't forget extension number 3. Heather, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Heather.
I have a question about some garlic.
I have a question for you first.
Sure thing.
Where are you?
I'm in Southeast Michigan. I'm about 40, 50 minutes outside of Detroit.
Oh, okay. All right. I've been to that area many times. Red Oak, especially when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we had an office there. Or is it Royal Oak? What am I getting it wrong?
Oh, no. I'm actually in Ypsilanti. We're, you know, the other side, but.
Okay.
No, but nobody knows Ypsilanti.
All right. What can we do for Heather near Detroit?
Yeah, so I have been listening to the show for a while, and you are always on about the virtues of garlic, and I finally put some in the ground, and it looks like I take that out in the middle of the summer. It's kind of hot to get stuff going, but it seems like there's still plenty of time before the fall, so I was wondering, you know, what can I mix in there in that time between when I pull the garlic out of the ground and when I still have plenty of light and warmth?
Well, really, it is, in my mind, too short a period of time to do much because we have been advising gardeners in the north to get their garlic in a lot earlier than the advice used to be. It used to be wait till Columbus Day, but growers in the Pocono Mountains here have discovered that putting it in August gives you better results, better bulbs. The cloves you plant have a longer time to develop strong roots in case you get a really nasty, horrible winter. They're better prepared to resist that. So, you know, in my garden, I pull my garlic generally around the 4th of July, but it's like over a 3-week stretch. And, you know, I pick like a dozen heads at a time, let them cure under a ceiling fan for a week, and then pull another run. So there's not a lot of time, but you also want to avoid planting in the same spot over and over again. It's better to have something that's finishing up or that you let go fallow from another plant. Say you grew peas that wiped out in the beginning of July. They're called June peas because they rarely get to see a day in July. Well, you know, July is followed by August, so what I would do is take that area where you grew peas or lettuce or any other springtime crop, harvest the last of that, cover it with shredded leaves, which I hope you have, and, you know, plant in August when really when your cloves are ready from your harvest, your first harvest here that we're bringing in, you know, because they need to cure, they need to dry, they need to settle out. And what I generally do is during August, I'll be examining my bulbs and separating out big perfect ones from ones that have little imperfections. And then when it's planting time, I go to those big perfect ones and I tear those apart, and I plant the biggest cloves that I have. That's the recipe for garlic success. But I have found out the hard way that you can create a disease problem if you plant garlic in the same spot over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So do the rotation by moving beds. Maybe think about something different.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
not related to garlic for the fall, but it's going to be like a seasonal bed rotation.
Yeah. Don't forget, I learned this the hard way by having dedicated garlic beds, and that caught up to me after about 12 years.
That sounds like a real hassle.
Oh, you know, 1 year I completely lost the entire crop to neck rot. Oh. Luckily, I had had such a great harvest the previous year, I'd given lots of bulbs away, and the people I gave them to replanted the cloves from those bulbs, and then were happy to give me a couple of bulbs apiece in return, and that got me off to a fresh start.
Oh, that's great. Garlic goes around, garlic comes around, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Spread the wealth.
Okay.
All right, so is that awesome. A plan?
That's a plan. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling, should you never improve the soil in the planting hole? Erica, who lives in gardens in Wheatfield, New York, which is between Buffalo and Niagara Falls, writes, last spring, I bought a bundle of young serviceberry bushes from my county extension. They were about a foot to 18 inches high apiece. I followed the instructions to first plant them in a nursery bed, a brand new flower bed that I had filled with municipal compost and lots of perlite. They have done well and are leafing out beautifully. I'd like to transplant them to their permanent location in my crummy clay soil this fall, which would give them about a year and a half of growing up in the, quote, nursery. But if I dig them up with lots of the loose, rich soil they're in now, I fear I will be guilty of, quote, improving the soil in the hole, and thus discouraging them from pushing their roots into my crummy clay. But if I shake off all that nice soil, I fear I will damage the roots and kill them. As you can see, I have just enough knowledge to be dangerous. Actually, you have just enough knowledge to ask a darn good question, Erica. And before I fumble around for the answer, I would like to take a moment to praise your choice of plant. The serviceberry, aka Juneberry, Shadberry, and about a dozen other common names, is a remarkable plant. It's native, comes in both the form of a tree and is a multi-branching shrub, and is one of the earliest plants to produce fruit, hence the Juneberry tag. Those fruits look a lot like blueberries and taste like a combination of blueberries and almonds. At least the best ones do. Like mulberries, the fruit quality can vary considerably from plant to plant. Some taste great eaten raw, some are fit only for making jam. Hey, if you add enough sugar, you can make anything taste good. They're a great plant for wildlife as well. Several moth and butterfly caterpillars eat the leaves. Birds eat the fruits. And deer will eat the whole thing to the ground if you aren't careful. Now, you have the principle down perfectly. If you fill the new planting holes with nice amendments like potting soil, peat moss, compost, perlite, and/or vermiculite to create a wonderful, welcoming environment, the roots of your new plants will remain inside that welcoming environment instead of fighting their way out into your crummy clay. In such a situation, they develop so few lateral roots that you can often lift them right out of the ground 4 or 5 years down the line. Are there exceptions? Yes. Blueberries, which are also a native fruit, naturally grow in highly acidic, peaty soil, aka peat bogs, so you really should backfill their holes with a mix of milled peat moss and some compost to help hold the peat in place. Back to serviceberries. You have been a good mother so far, and you are correct that late summer / early fall is the ideal time to plant new trees and shrubs. But I think that a year is enough time to spend in the nursery and move out into the real world. Spring planting is perfectly acceptable, especially in your upstate New York, where harsh summertime temperatures aren't due until late July, and even then only last a month or so before a nighttime chill returns to the air. Hey, sorry, but I have been up there. But don't dig the babies out of their cribs. Soak the soil thoroughly and pull them up ever so gently. Don't worry about any nice soil that still hangs on to the roots. Their new spot should have the best drainage you can provide and excellent air circulation. And be sure to dig super wide planting holes. It's good to bust up the clay, just don't replace it. There's an old expression in this game, dig a wide hole, not a deep one. So go to town on the sideways action on that clay. Position the plants high up in their new planting spaces. With trees, you have the root flare as a guide. You always want to see that root flare above ground after planting. With shrubs, you're going to have to use your own best judgment. Whatever you do, don't bury them deep. A little too high is much better than a little too low. Fill those holes back up with the same crummy clay soil you dug up. No cheating! Then let a hose just drip at the surface of the soil for several hours for each plant. Let that soil settle. Recheck the height and adjust it if you need to, then mulch with 2 inches of that wonderful yard waste compost, beginning 6 inches away from the base of the plant, but going out as far as you'd like those roots to spread. And then have a fast hand with the drip hose if you go a week without rain or if it gets really hot. You wish. Last time I checked, global warming was still scared of your part of the country. Some additional information. Bare root plants that arrive without their roots in soil. Soak those dried roots in a bucket of clean water for several hours before planting as above to rehydrate them. Plants that arrive in pots. Turn the pots on their side and rotate them until the dirt-covered roots slide right out of the pots. Then use a garden knife to dive down and gently loosen up those roots before planting. Don't worry about a little nick here and there. Tell people you're root pruning. That'll impress them. Then plant as above. That sure was a timely warning about how to not plant short-lived lollipops now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the written details over at your leisure or your leisure, plus peruse a peck of previous questions of the week by following the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer's threatening to bury my baby trees if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. That's 610-694-8100, extension 3. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse, teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. No matter how you communicate with us, please, please include your location. You will find our phone number, our Gmail address, a link to the written version of that all-important question of the week, links to our priceless podcast, and a link to the College Hill Neighborhood Association website, where you can register for my May 10th appearance at the Eastern Nurture Nature Center. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when a lovely young woman told him that all she wanted was a guy who could grow raspberries for her. Luckily, raspberries are very easy to grow. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprot. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be moving my pepper plants into their final containers, where they will enjoy the summer outdoors before coming back inside and continuing to produce over the fall and winter until I see you again next week.